It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My next guest has the most recognizable voice in public radio.
My cat, she pleaded, and my cat, she cried for me to open up the door and let her go outside. Then she sat on the lawn underneath a tree, pretending that she couldn't hear me as I said, cat.
Garrison Keillor and the rest of the cast of A Prairie Home Companion will be performing on Saturday evening at the Des Moines Civic Center, and Keillor will also be making a few appearances at bookstores in the state, including a Prairie Lights appearance in Iowa City on Sunday evening, promoting his new collection, The Keillor Reader. And he is with me today. Garrison, this collection is more of a retrospective. There is some news from Lake Wobegon, but it also takes us outside of Lake Wobegon. Did you get to decide what you wanted to include?
I did. I set to work on it, and the publisher wanted to put out a volume, a collected volume. I'd never done one before. Was reluctant to do it now because, you know, I'm not done writing, so you know, I was a little bit uncomfortable about the memorial aspect of that. But I went out and did it and made the selection. Basically, I chose parts of novels, essays, stories, some monologues from the show that I thought would sound okay if I read them aloud. That was sort of my criterion. Having been in radio all these years that I've also been writing for print, I think that the voice is sort of crucial to whatever literary style I have, and that whenever I get too far away from the way I talk or the way people around me talk, I'm in trouble. Whenever I get into the metaphysical, you know, and get into writing that's a little too self-consciously literary, I'm probably writing something that I would be better off throwing away.
Well, and people have been hearing your voice for so many years. I know that when I read anything written by you, it's as if you're reading it to me in my head. So that may make it even more important.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, of course. I was just sort of thinking about myself, you know, and what would sound good read out loud. I don't do readings anymore. I mean, I like to stand up in front of people and improvise, but I don't stand up and read out loud because whenever I do, I can't keep myself from revising, you know, and editing on the fly. I don't do that as other writers do.
In returning to some of this work from many years ago, how did that feel, reading what you wrote decades ago?
It felt unnatural. I don't do that as a rule. I just absolutely wouldn't do that. Sit down and open up a book that I had written years ago and plunge into it. A writer has to keep moving forward, but that's, you know, that's true of radio as well. It's the beauty of radio is that it's self-erasing, and after you do a show, after I do A Prairie Home Companion, a few hours later I've forgotten most of what I did, and I'm thinking about the next one.
Did
so
any,
it was unnatural.
Yeah. Did
unnatural
anything surprise you when you were looking back at this work?
No. I was all business. I wasn't about trying to assess this, you know, and its value and its weight and its place in American literature. I just don't think that way because I'm a radio guy, you know. I also am a writer. I think I'm basically a writer, but I've picked up some of the best of both worlds. And one characteristic of radio people, I think, is a certain lack of self-consciousness. I feel that way. We just after you've been doing it for a while, you just plunge forward.
You wrote some original work for this as well. You gave a little bit of insight into the different chapters and the different essays that you publish. And you write a little bit nostalgically about that first period in your life when you were just a writer. That was your only vocation. But then, of course, as you said, you went back to radio. And I was struck in thinking about the life of a writer. Of course, you had to make a living, but you weren't driven by deadlines like you are in radio, where you have a deadline once a week. How does that deadline change your creative process?
It requires you to be more organized than you really are. And it's a struggle. It's a lifelong struggle to be ready for a radio show like A Prairie Home Companion. I am a great postponer and procrastinator. I've never managed to reform. And so you know going into a week that Wednesday is going to be kind of empty, and then Thursday is going to be sort of anxiety-ridden, and then Friday is going to be a steeplechase, and Saturday is going to be chaos. And then Sunday, you go to church and ask forgiveness, and then you start all over. It's a routine. I've been doing it now for 40 years, and I don't expect to ever really change that. I did have a deadline when I was simply a freelance writer. I was writing fiction for the New Yorkers, living with my family on a farm out in central Minnesota, and the deadline was your checking account. You know, it got down to a certain point, and you started to think very serious thoughts, and you started to work long hours, because when you sent the next batch of stories off to New York to the editor, you knew that he had to buy one of them. He just had to. Otherwise, what would you do? I went to the bank once in Freeport, Minnesota, and I asked to borrow money based on my notes for a novel. I showed them the outline, and they were stunned. They'd given money to farmers, you know, lent money for crops, for soybeans, for swine, but they'd never been asked by a writer to lend him money for an unwritten novel. They were very polite. They said, "I don't think we can do that. Good luck."
For a lot of people who have been listening to you for many, many years, the line between fact and fiction may be a little bit fuzzy. And you even included one of the essays in which you are a character in your own monologue about Lake Wobegon. And people love that when you cross that line.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that a lot of people feel like they really know you well because they've been listening to your stories for all of these years. Do you run into that in real life, that line between fact and fiction on a regular basis, where people have a lot of false assumptions about you?
No, because when I meet people who listen to the show, we don't talk about me, we talk about them. I am a writer, and I am in steady need of material, and I'm not interested in talking about myself to people I meet in airports and sometimes sit down next to on a plane or you meet at a book signing. I'm interested in them, and I get the subject off me and onto them immediately. And the people are happy to talk about themselves. They love talking about themselves. And there's something about them, and, you know, whose boy is this? This is your boy. Oh, well, tell me about this boy. What's he? You know, he's 13. Well, yeah. And how's that going? And what is he studying? And what do you do? And they're happy to tell you. And you collect all sorts of ideas this way. This is how writers live. We don't walk around and and discourse about ourselves. We're vacuum cleaners.
Would you describe yourself?
Nubby, huh?
Yeah.
Nubby. Okay.
Write that down. Right.
I don't think I'll create a character named Nubby, but I could create a character named Charity. I could very easily do that. I'm thinking, go ahead, whatever you're going to ask.
Would you describe yourself as a shy person?
I am, but you learn to deal with that, and you get over that. Because to maintain the habit of shyness is, it's not polite. It just is not nice. You have to break through your own reluctance, and you have to learn to look people in the eye and to say who you are and to make conversation. I have no patience for people who sit there at the dinner table with strangers and refuse to pull their own weight conversationally. Shyness is not an excuse for being impolite.
In this collection...
Wasn't that good? I just said that.
That was very good.
Wasn't that good?
That's quotable.
I'm really pleased. I just came up with that. Shyness is no excuse for impoliteness.
Somebody needs to put that up on Pinterest right away.
Okay.
In this collection, you write quite poignantly about people who you loved and have lost. And you write that those who are gone are in some ways closer to us than the people who are living, but we don't see on a regular basis. Is that something you've found, that people you've lost are with you more?
I do. I think that's so true. I was sitting last night around the kitchen table with my cousin, and he had brought me a photograph of his mother, my Aunt Eleanor, who was my most beloved aunt. She was funny. She was smart. She was athletic. She could throw a softball. She could run. She was a wonderful aunt, and she and I loved each other. She's so present in my life. She comes back to me, two or three times a day. What would she think of this? What would she say, my aunt? Whereas I have cousins my age, and they've moved away. They've moved away to Seattle, they're off in Tucson, they're down in Greenville, South Carolina, and they're not in touch. And they've vanished somehow. Whereas her death made her a part of my interior. She's in my head.
One of the essays you include in this collection is called "My Stroke, I'm Over It." And mm-hmm. I know a lot of people care a lot about you and were very frightened when you had your stroke. How is your health?
It's good. I mean, I go bounding around and I get up at 5 in the morning and I go until midnight. It's perfectly fine. As long as you feel fine, you probably are fine. You have to go on that basis. I was very lucky. It was a memorable event, but I didn't fall down. I maintained my feet. I just kind of felt this odd sensation in my head, and then I got in my car because I'm a Minnesota guy, and I don't dial 911 for myself. I would do it for you, but I'm not going to do it for myself. I drove very carefully about 15 miles to hospital, and I walked in. And boy, when you walk into that triage desk, in the emergency room, and this woman in blue looks up at you and you say, I think I'm having a stroke. Boy, you get their attention right away. They got this guy with a gurney out there in about 90 seconds, and they wheel you in, and before you know it, you're undressed in a little blue robe, and a neurologist is tapping your kneecap.
I know we need to let you go, but I want to ask you, you're coming to Iowa to perform this coming weekend, and the legend around here has it that WOI Radio in Ames was the first station outside of Minnesota to carry a Prairie Home Companion. I don't know if that's 100% true, but it was definitely one of the early stations. Of course, you won a Peabody for your performance in Ames while the show was still quite young. What does it mean to you to perform in Iowa?
Well, I'm coming to a state that has always been kind to Prairie Home Companion. The show goes down to Des Moines regularly. I haven't been to Iowa City for a while, but I think we were in Ames just a few years ago. It was the first place outside of Minnesota. We used to send the show to them on a big 15-inch Ampex reel tape. It was sent on tape, and so that was back in the very early days. So they carried it a week after it had broadcast live in Minnesota. That was huge when we went down to Ames and that big auditorium that sits up high and proud on the campus. I remember that. That was a very dramatic event going down there, wondering how this will go. Does this thing have a future? We still don't know, by the way. Still trying to figure that out.
Well, maybe that will become clear. Garrison Keillor, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Charity.
Garrison Keillor, a Prairie Home Companion, will be live at the Des Moines Civic Center on Saturday, and he'll be reading at First United Methodist Church in Iowa City on Sunday evening at 7 as part of Live from Prairie Lights. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.